wanted to ask you, as I was, tell me about your grandparents.
Yes. Well, my family doesn't come from Riga, as far as the centuries are concerned. Riga was outside the Pale of Settlement. The only Druids who could live there were of two categories. One was a mysterious category, which I won't dwell on. People were there before Peter the Great conquered it. They were then the Swedes. Right, there's a minute community. But I once met a Jew in Riga who said in German, by den alten Schweden. I'm the old Swedes, it wasn't so. This was said,
so God knows
when, 1914 and 15, I mean, yeah. I was 6 foot or five. Yeah. But I remember a man who said, I'm the old Swedes, yeah. Which was 200 years before.
Yeah. But your family does not come from that.
No. The other kind of Jews who live in Riga all come from Russia. And they move for business reasons. Now, under the laws of the Pale of Settlement, created really by, but rather earlier, but tightened by your great-grandfather, the rules were as follows. No Jews could live outside the Pale, which was roughly Lithuania, Eastern Poland, bits of Ukraine, I think. Unless, there were two conditions. Three. One, if they were promoted to being members of the gentry, which was true of about five families, not more, maybe seven. Two, if they had professions, if they were dentists, if they were nailmen, anything you like, nail makers, I mean, whatever, artisans who supplied something, actually create something. Three, if their turnover, business turnover, exceeded a certain sum, in which they were called merchants of the first guild. Merchants divided into guilds. The guilds were determined by the turnover, not by actual capital. This is true of all Russians, I mean, not just the Jews. All merchants are written down as merchants in the order of the states. And the guildia, the actual guild, was noted in their documents. Merchants of the first guild could live anywhere. But that meant a certain degree of wealth. Now, the kind of Jews that live in Riga, I think I better give you the social hierarchy. At the top in Latvia were the Baltic barons. They were counts or barons, as you might be. They came in the 15th century. The Riga was conquered by the Knights of the Sword. The Lithuanians were baptized fairly late. The Lithuanians in the 15th century, and the latest. They had large estates, which they did by conquest. Under this Latvia and Lithuania, the Baltic provinces passed from hand to hand, from Sweden to Poland, Poland to Sweden, ultimately Russia. They kept their estates.
To Russia?
What?
Pardon the question of ignorance, but when to Russia?
From Peter the Great. Yes. About 1713.
In the battle with the Swedes.
After the battle with the Swedes. Must have been after Poltava. Must have been, I think. That was a famous window into Europe. Famous phrase, prorubil okno v Evropu. He hacked.
Right.
He broke a window into Europe. Yeah. The window into Europe was Petersburg. Yeah. But although a bit
the
Swedish.
The literal as well.
No, it was a bit Swedish.
Yeah.
And after turning up, he eliminated the Charles the Twelfth of Sweden, that he conquered all these provinces and married Catherine the Great, Catherine the First.
Yeah.
She was a nobody quite knows what relation was. Pastor, some such name as Pastor Gluck, some such name, or she is mistress, or she is servant. And depends on whether you were left wing, right or right wing, right or writing about Peter the Great. But anyhow, she was captured by Menshikov, who was Peter's, in effect, vizier.
Yeah.
And Peter the Great took her from him,
yes.
Married her, and she became empress after him.
Yes.
She was a Baltic girl.
Yes.
Whatever it.
The Jews.
Yes, no Jews then.
Come in the van.
No Jews, no Jews, no. No Jews in Russia at all, officially then.
Yes.
Jews are not admitted to Russia at any stage. But the partition of Poland brings in that portion of Poland.
Yes.
There may be, if you look at historians, there are crypto Jews. There's something called the Jewish heresy, which means there was something is going on, which had to be eliminated by the church. But there were certainly settlements. Yes. There were concealed, hidden, under other names. No doubt there were individual Jews who filtered in from Germany, but there was no settlement, there were no Jews officially known to exist. The Empress Elizabeth, Peter's daughter, was asked if she would like to admit some Jews because commerce and trade would be stimulated by them. She said, from the enemies of Christ, I do not desire even profit. Mm-hmm. See, and so they were not admitted. And under Catherine the Great, there was a partition of Poland, I would say, which conquered a large chunk of Jews, you see, in eastern Poland and Lithuania was part of Poland.
Yes.
These ones. Yes. Right. We will go back to Riga. At the top of these Baltic bands, they're called Benkendorf, they're called Korf, they're called, I suppose, I don't know what else they're called, Kaiserling, those sort of names. Counts. Mudberg, countries like Baroness. Barons and counts. They're at the top. They spoke German at home and were fanatical supporters of the Russian throne. They got jobs at the court, they were made governors, they were made heads of the police, they were much favored because of their fanatical loyalty. They were detested by the Russians at all times. And sometimes they didn't feel it. It was unlike the sort of Prince of Pushkin of German origin. That is a bit different. But the top Germans were regarded as a kind of, not exactly aliens, but reactionary oppressors. Very Germanic type. Under them came rich German merchants. In Riga, who in the 19th century created the German opera, the German theater. The conductor of the German opera in the 1840s was Wagner. The conductor in the around 1900 was Bruno Walter. So it was a real German outpost. Riga was not a Russian town at any stage, for practical purposes. There was the only Russians in Riga were the Governor General, the police, bits of the army probably, fruit vendors, newspaper vendors, odds and ends. But it was not, they spoke Russian because people had to, because of all, they were part of the empire, they had to be for 200 years. But fundamentally, Russians did not feel at home in Riga and didn't inhabit it. No Russians were any settled in a comfortable way. Same is true of Finland, of Estonia, same is true of Finland, or even more. Finland had its own parliament. These people didn't. Now, under the great German merchants, rich German merchants, were Scandinavian merchants also, the same type, Danes, Swedes, Norwegians who traded with the hinterland with Russia. My main occupation was, I suppose, exporting things from the great Russian hotpot and manufacturing things and so on. Very prosperous. Under the German merchants came the poorer German merchants. Underneath that came the Germanized Jews, who were quite civilized, quite well educated, gave talk German at home, quite cultivated, couldn't get into German and Russian university because of the equator, and so tend to go to Königsberg or Berlin to be educated, and came back to Riga. Doctors, engineers, Eisenstein, a typical example. Some are baptized Jew. You see, baptism helped, but not much. If you were baptized, of course you would live anywhere, but you remained a Jew. I mean, the baptized Jews, friends of baptized Jews, are the baptized Jews, I suspect. It helped up to a point. Legally, it certainly did. Socially, not overly much, in my impression. Under some suspicion. And their grandchildren probably all right. They themselves not. Then, under the richer German, the more cultivated Jews, bourgeoisie, came the ghetto. The ghetto meant quite rich people sometimes, but of Yiddish, lived mainly in a place called the Krasnaya Dvina, Rote Düne. Dvina was a river, you see. As you know, Düne in German. Dvinsk is Dünaburg. And Mitava is Mitau. and all these kinds of Russian engines. And
how was the ghetto enforced?
It wasn't enforced. It was not chosen. These people had a legal right to live there, so it wasn't enforced in that sense. But they were poor, they were Yiddish speaking, they lived in poor lodgings, they crowded together, like the East End of London.
And they had come from Poland, they had come from the partition.
Russia, in the 19th century. I don't think many people came from Poland in the 18th. I think it just stayed there. And maybe they couldn't be infiltrated in Russia because they weren't allowed to, under the laws of exclusion. You see, your great grandfather created a rather tightened law by which no Jew from the Pale could remain for 24 hours anywhere outside.
Yes, or acquire agricultural land.
No, but if he spent a night
yes.
in Petersburg, they were arrested.
Yes.
Weizmann
yes.
couldn't spend a night. Yes. You see? So, yes. Yes. That wasn't so, I think, in the 1870s. Yes. They came so late. So it's called the temporary laws, for some reason, not ironically. Now, very many as I call me. Now, these Jews were pious, Yiddish speaking, as they might be in any other Russian Pale settlement. No difference. Except that their children could go to secular schools, unless prevented by the parents. They were taught Hebrew, the old Bible, taught bits of Talmud, exactly like anyone. But it was thinner. There weren't so many of them. They weren't surrounded by the Jews. So that my grandparents belonged to that. Now let me tell you in particular. They lived in the ghetto. And they were Hasidic. That meant that the center of their spiritual life was Lubavitch, small town in Western Russia, where the saint the saintly leaders had held court. And they were called the Chabad Hasidim, and I am descended from the founder in direct line. Not the direct male line, the direct line was him. And my seventh cousin, Yehuda Menuhin, is also descended from him.
And the founder is, his name is?
Schneur Zalman. Schneur Zalman are Hebrew names. He was called Schneur Zalman Schneerson. Because he had to have a Russian name. He was born about 1730. And he founded this, the origin, I won't go into this, it's too boring. The origin of Hasidism is the early 18th century in the Carpathians. This is the Russian branch. They were Methodists. They believed in union with God, emotion. Out with clericalism, out with not much respect for learning. Not much respect for the rigid hierarchical structure of the Jews in the Middle Ages. Some kind of spiritual outbreak of a slightly corybantic, slightly, that's what I mean, Quaker Shaker type. It's exactly the same. The mystery is that the Moravian brothers, from whom Methodists are in descent, direct line, got going at about the same time as the Jews, in roughly the same part of the country. There was no trace of a contact. Zeitgeist works in very mysterious ways. Right, well, my ancestor was much more severe than the others. He did believe in learning. He disciplined them. There was no wild, no excesses. He kept them in order. But he was persecuted by the official rabbinate as a disagreeable... I mean, liturgically they were not heretical. But their habits and outlook and general view of life was regarded as unfortunate because they didn't... Learning is what we had lived by. They were rather contemptuous of it. They were accused of drinking vodka in order to get into mystical states and other such things. And my ancestor was denounced to the Russian government by the great sages of Vilna, which was the center of Judaism in that part of the world, as in some way subversive. He was put in jail. And his followers to this day celebrate the day on which he was let out. And they have sort of dances. They danced. But the other Jews did not do. And that was so. And the certain holidays they danced around the Torah, on the back. That's the kind of thing. Now, my family, both my parents' first cousins, my father's father and my mother's mother, my brother and sister, and they in their turn were descended from the granddaughter of the third saint of the dynasty, who was the grandson of the founder. So the the status is terrific among those old Jews. You must understand that what happened was this. I think I better tell you these fragments of my biography. Among the Jews of that sort, let's say 95% of Jews inhabiting Russia, there were only two ways of acquiring status. One was learning, the other was money. Either you were very rich, very important, or you could be a much looked up to man of colossal learning who could, if you gave him a tractate of the Talmud, which are at least 60, each of which has about 50,000 to 60,000 words, if you put a pin on a given letter on page one, he could tell you which letter came on every other page underneath. This wasn't frequent, but it could happen. It was a fantastic exercise of the brain over nothing. You see what I mean? These were the learned volumes of the Talmud, mainly legalistic. But they started at the age of four. By the time they were 17, they were chock-a-block with this. They had no other life. Now, if you were a rich man, what you wanted was your son to marry the daughter of a learned man, or your daughter to marry the son of a learned man. Hence these cross-marriages occurred. And that was the way these people genetically developed. Now, in the 1860s, there was a man called Berlin who bought some land, which he was allowed to buy before the laws came down. I think during some period of Alexander II's reign, they could. A railroad built over this land so that his capital became something like 15 times sterling. He became multimillionaire. He still spoke Yiddish, had no contact. You must understand that in the Pale of Settlement, these people had no social contract with their surroundings. They, around them, were peasants, illiterate, Christian, barbarous. They were literate in Hebrew. They spoke enough Russian to barter goods of the natives, not much. And they were completely state within the state. And because the Russian government forced them into certain territories, adjacency developed. That made them into a national minority. They were not in Germany or America or wherever they could live scattered away. But here they were crammed into certain territories which produced the artificial effect of something like Ruthenians, you see. And that's what gave them a national identity without it all being intended that way. And that's what created Zionism in the end. The fact that they were a close community, territorially congested, with the same narrow bottleneck. I see what I mean. It's quite interesting. This isn't usually said by historians, but it was a major factor. So that they simply traveled with their household goods to Palestine, they simply took their culture with them, because they had no contact with the neighbors. That's the whole trouble with the Arabs, is that. You see, just as they looked at the Russian peasants, they didn't hate them, but they feared them. From time to time, priests would appear, pogrom to appear, with some kind of Kresny Chod, some kind of religious procession that might result in hating the, killing the Christ killers. Well, Arabs were exactly the same to them. When they got to Palestine, these were remote people who couldn't communicate with. Barbarians spoke another language, nothing with us. That was psychology. The only people who talked to Arabs were liberal Jews in Manna, tried to get into contact for high-minded reasons. You can imagine.
Who precisely is this Berlin who becomes a multimillionaire?
Wait. He's just a merchant. I don't know anything about him. He's just a merchant in Western Russia. He has two sons. One of the sons, who was called Isaiah, went to Riga. What they owned was forests. The forests were cut, made into rafts, by peasants. The rafts floated down the Dvina River, Lamba, arrive in Riga, which was the port. There they were sawn into planks, logs, whatever it may be, and then sold to the West. And the man I'm speaking of settled himself in Riga with 100 persons working for him. If they worked for him, they were all right, because then they could be described as having professions. A log cutter or a clerk.
They are Jews.
They were all Jews. He employed nobody else. He could employ nobody else. He couldn't communicate with anybody else. Yiddish is the only language he spoke. He was very, very rich. Now, that's the strange part of the whole story. A little bit. Now, in Riga, if you were a dentist, you had 17 assistants, all of whom were called dentists, none of whom knew anything about dentistry. In order to inscribe those dentists, you had to bribe the police, which we did. There were two sorts of policemen, good policemen, bad policemen. Good policemen took bribes, bad policemen didn't. Good governors, bad governors. Good officials, bad officials. Exact inversion of values. Exact. The good were people who let you live for a price. The bad people did not let you live, even for a price. That was psychology. Now, this rich man married the daughter of one of these wonder rabbis. He was a Hasid, so he brought up as one. Now he went to Lubavitch every year at some festival and took food with the, and that's subsidized the saint with how he lived. Enough rich people to make offerings. And the whole thing is highly superstitious. But anyway, he had to go once a year on a pilgrimage to the, and consult him about business, the Delphic Oracle. Because so many people told him about themselves, had some knowledge. What is going on? Probably give quite good advice. Anyway, he married the granddaughter of one of these splendid saints. He had no children. Her sister, whose name was Zuckerman, no, who married the man, her name was Schneerson, which was the name of the saint, of the wonder rabbi. These rabbis didn't perform miracles. In Poland and Hungary they did, but in this particular sect, in Lubavitch, they were perfectly sane. They were fanatical but sane. And her name was Schneerson, and she married a man called Zuckerman. Zuckerman was a man who spent his entire day in the synagogue, but totally incapable of doing anything. A sort of saintly figure who poured over the Bible, was halfway to backward. She kept the shop, and she got the goods, and she was an active, intelligent woman, who I still met. Her son, wait a minute, her son, that's right, my father, her son was my father's father, and her daughter was my mother's mother.
Just to check that I heard something correctly.
This is the sister-in-law, the shopkeeper, or the sister-in-law of the millionaire. Now, he wanted progeny, so he adopted my grandfather on the condition he changed his name. Hence Berlin, yes. That's why I'm not related to great many other Berlins. It's a Jewish name. God knows why. It's nothing to do with the town. I think it probably has to do with Bear, Berl, Russian Indian. It's my theory. But I didn't know these things. Anyhow, he adopted my grandfather, who was a nerdy wheel. Never did anything at all. But was quite richly brought up. And he married...
What would richly brought up mean in that
context? That he was brought up in a comfortable house and looked after by servants and didn't have to...
But again, a strictly...
Narrow piety.
A strictly Jewish world.
Couldn't be more. He spoke only Yiddish, my grandfather. My grandmother did it. Now, his son, my father, was born in, theoretically in Riga, officially in the Bais Pasu. In fact, I think he was born in Vitebsk. And his mother...
Can you remember the date of your father's birth?
It's in 1883. My mother was born in 1880. His father married the daughter of another Hasidic rabbi. That's how things happened. She was not uneducated. My father went to a German school in Riga. It was bilingual. In Russian and German. He spoke Yiddish because he had to.
At home. A German school in Riga, but within the ghetto. A Jew entirely.
No.
He begins to move out.
No. Not the ghetto. He was allowed. German school in Riga, among Germans.
Yes.
No. He was allowed to. He was évolué. It's exactly like Lebanese. Speak French.
Now that's interesting.
My mother also.
But isn't that a
school.
Moment then in which your family tradition changes?
Yes. By the 1890s, and by 1895, if you live in Riga, you were not forced. There was not enough fanaticism. The children of these people, because they lived in Riga, went to German schools. It's quite common.
What's happening
example,
here?
I'll tell you an example of a man like that. When you were in Israel, did you hear the name of a man called Leibovich? He's exactly that. He comes from Riga. He's about, 7 years older than I am. His parents were exactly that. They were already educated in German schools, like my father. His grandfather was exactly like my family. That was typical. He was highly educated. He went to Königsberg, Berlin. He was a highly sophisticated biochemist.
I still don't understand how this happens, because I would have thought that the Hasidic traditions would be hostile.
They weren't strong enough.
But
there was no Hasidic rabbi in Riga. The whole thing was too remote. And by this, it wasn't the heart of the Jews there were not, they were a colony. They weren't part of the sort of mass of the Jews. For some reason, the sheer assimilation, the sheer life of Germans around them, the fact that my father had to travel about Europe selling the timber, couldn't do that unless he knew languages. It was clear he was an able boy, and so since everything was left to him, it was decided to, I suppose, to Europeanize him. This is true of his entire generation. They all learned, they spoke Russian and German. My parents.
So to resume, you have a great-grandfather who's a kind of, or an adopted great-grandfather.
I have an adopted grandfather.
Who is a?
No, my grandfather's adopted. He's adopted by his uncle.
Yes, it's the uncle I'm referring to. The uncle is devout, devoutly religious, tremendously
successful.
My
grandfather's father was called Zuckerman.
Yes.
His wife was of the royal family. Was he Hasidic?
Yes.
But he was not.
Yes. I'm trying to trace a descent in which you have a movement away from this Hasidic.
Oh, I'm no longer part of it at all.
Yes. But that's already begun in your father's
time. Absolutely. In fact, my mother was allowed to go as a girl to a German school and became word perfect in German. Was already, and she was the daughter of a super fanatical father who did not allow her to play the piano, did not allow her to learn to sing in a sort of Puritan way. Hasidim were not Puritans, but he was, as it happens. Nevertheless, such was the morality of these Jews in Riga that apparently they could not resist that degree of assimilation. I can't tell you. You see, it's the case of my pseudo great grandfather, the rich man. I can tell you how he lived, and you'll see. Every summer, every winter, he went to Mentone, South France. Four villas were taken. He went with staff about 40 people. This Maharaja is what he was thinking in terms of. These 40 people were sent by train to Paris, was direct train Riga to Paris. There they went to the guichet, where they were told, donnez-moi une boulette pour troisième classe Menton. They got their boulette and they went to Menton. When they arrived at Menton, they scattered themselves. These villas, what were they? Two rabbis, a kosher butcher, a kosher slaughterer, court fools, clerks, favorites. It was an oriental thing. And in these four villas, these kind of months. And then went rural back to Riga. Every winter, in winter, every summer he went to Bad Homburg. Same thing. But there, you could talk to German merchants, because Yiddish was sufficiently close to German for communication to occur. And there were clients, there were people who bought his goods. They called, because he was so rich. And they wanted to ingratiate themselves. Communication was slightly easier. Now, he was made hereditary honorary citizen of the Russian Empire. That was given to rich merchants, which meant he could go anywhere and live anywhere. Certain privileges. His children did not need to go to the army unless he made them. Every morning the Governor General, General Zvigintsev, sent a messenger to inquire after his health. Every afternoon he sent a messenger to inquire after the health of the Governor General of Livlandia, which was a province, Livland.
Yes.
That was Latvia and Estonia, I would say.
When did this pseudo great-grandfather, Isaiah Berlin, die?
Before I was born. He died in about 1905, I think. About 1909, 1904, thereabouts. But everything was done by him. He was the patriarch. And
depended on him, your pseudo great-grandfather. What about your grandfather? You said a ne'er-do-well.
Yeah, absolutely. He did nothing at all. I mean, he had enough money to live on because he was given it. He tried to do business, but failed time and time again, but had to prevent it. His wife was competent. She was a very competent woman. She ran the household, had four sons and two daughters, all of whom remained in the Soviet Union. That's another story. Apart from my father, who was the eldest. But my father became the favorite of the millionaire.
Yes.
And brought up by mortgage by hand. And he was the chief manager of the fair and traveled around Europe.
Just to give my sense of this milieu, does the family live in a kind of patriarchal compound? Is it
not mine, not my bit. My family moves out of the ghetto quite early on, long before I was born. It's understood they are bourgeoisie. They become middle class and they go on seeing these people and being on terms with them, and are permitted to move into better quarters. So they live in a large, broad street called the Albertstrasse, Albertovskaya, in a large building, as I told you, with two sphinxes on either side, on the fourth floor containing about 12 rooms. You see, that's straight bourgeois life, such as any German merchant.
An apartment on one
floor. A proper apartment, in the smart part of the
Yes.
They move in 1900. My father is 20. My mother's 53.
They marry when?
Maybe they married a little. They must have married probably a bit before that. They married in 1901 or two.
What do you know of what do you know of your father's education?
There was no university in Riga at all. He could have gone to Dorpat, which was the German university in Estonia. It still exists. It's still one of the best universities in the Soviet Union, Germanic type. They're called Tartu. But Dorpat or Derpt. Yuryev is a Russian name. It's a Zhukovsky word.
Yes.
Those sort of people.
Yes.
But they struck from the German. He's a sort of Baltic university. He went to Polytechnic in Riga. Now, he first went to school, classical education. He learned Greek. He learned Latin. Quite solidly in Riga, German teachers.
Does he also learn his Talmud?
Not really. Of course, when he was a boy, he was taught these things, but superficially. And once he went to school at the age of 11, he wasn't forced to go on the other. There just wasn't enough fanaticism of that kind.
Yes.
By then.
What about synagogue?
On Saturdays, the millionaire had his own synagogue, entirely paid for by him, kept by him, and entirely attended by his staff. That synagogue I went to as a child once or twice. I wasn't forced to go every Sabbath. Now and then, just thought it was an act of presence was needed, so about six seven, eight times a year. I was led to it, but that was entirely managed by his sort of people, and there was a Hasidic, some sort of minister, looked after it. That was after his death, so I can't tell you. And there wasn't, nobody was forced into it. Kosher, of course. And that, yes. I was taught Hebrew. That is said, no, I wasn't taught Hebrew. I wasn't taught Hebrew until we went to, I prepared. I was never taught German. My first nurse was the Latvian. I forgot to tell you, underneath these poor Jews came the vast bulk of the population of this country. They were Letts. They spoke Lettish. They were Helots. They didn't exist, humanly. Nobody had relations with them.
Not the Russians, not the Germans.
There were very few Russians. There were very few Russians. The Germans despised them and oppressed them. There were serfs working for the Baltic barons. In town there were servants. They were the lower classes. They spoke their own language, which nobody understood. It's a language which is closest to Sanskrit or any language in Europe. And the reason for that, I suspect, is that since nobody intermarried with them, it will be pure. They occasionally have German names, for some reason or another. But the point is, they did develop a national consciousness by 1905 or so. There were sculptors, there were minor poets. They began to rebel. I mean, they did finally produce a kind of native bourgeoisie, exactly as the Slovaks might have done.
And they come into your house, into your consciousness, as a nursemaid?
Servants and nursemaids, yes, certainly. One saw them in the streets, the bus tram conductors were, some shopkeepers were, but they spoke German, for our purposes. Some spoke Russian. But my mother happened to have a nurse who taught her Lettish. And that was very exceptional. I'll tell you a story about that afterwards, but that's what happened. Now, my nurse was a Latvian, but I was, I suppose, three when she abandoned me, so she talked German to me, or nothing, I don't know. Then I got a German nurse, at the age of 2½, I think, and then German, which I lost at the age of 4, when I got the Russian governess. Now, the early day of governesses was not in the ghetto. By this time, we are Western, for all these purposes.
Where is Yiddish, where is Hebrew in this?
Yiddish is spoken by my parents. And my parents knew it, because otherwise they couldn't communicate with their parents. And my parents, my father's brothers, didn't speak it. They were too young.
What do your parents speak to each other?
Russian. Occasionally German. Never Yiddish. But their parents, they did speak in Yiddish. That was all they could do. Didn't see them very much. But when they did, yes. But that was a plunge into the ghetto. My mother was brought up Yiddish speaking. But because of the German school, which she attended at the age of 10, Slavtov, it lingered. She never forgot it. I mean, it wasn't, we were, so to speak, well below the educated German sort of Jews who didn't speak it at all and disliked it. They got it as a slave language. It had nothing to do with it. I mean, my family comes the lower class in the end. Strictly speaking. And the grandparents certainly belong to the ghetto in the full sense. The parents are emancipated, more or less emancipated. So that after the, you say, well, what happens to me is this. I'm born in 1909. I get these.
What exact date?
6th of June. 24th of May was the Russian Revolution.
1909.
At the age of, by about 1914, the war breaks out. Every summer one goes to the seaside in Riga, and one bathes. One rides a bicycle. This is the ghetto Jews living there. The Jewish bourgeoisie does. There is a bourgeoisie. By this time, there must be 30,000 Jews like us. All of us speak
and
Russian
like us means,
or German. Russian
like us
or German.
Means there is no distinction sartorially.
Between them and the Germans, no.
Yes.
No.
nor in culture, in outward culture.
No, because they've got certain Jewish bases. Mm. They still are not fully Mitzvah, they know what's what. And of course, they have these oppressed cousins in Russia proper. I mean, they're second class citizens, or third class. But they have their own newspaper in Russia. It goes on after the revolution. Some of them become Zionists. This is quite early. There are no Yiddish speaking Zionists.
And what does it mean? Do you have a sense of what your father's politics were before the First World War?
Certainly, it is born a Russian liberal bourgeois. Liberal bourgeois, if he had chosen a political party, would have been a cadet. Okay. He's not a socialist of any order, not interested in that. He couldn't be anything at the right of that because they oppressed the Jews, because they were oppressors. Cadets were liberals.
Whereas presumably, your great grandparents or back of that would have no politics at all.
Remote. Some of their children probably ran away from them and became socialists. The great analogy I can tell you was produced by the late Sir Louis Nenier, who wrote an article in New Statesman, which had a considerable effect on me. It was a very good article on this topic. He comes from Galicia, but he knew what was what. He said the following. The Jews in Eastern Europe were a frozen mass of medieval kind. Middle Ages persisted among them. It's absolutely true, which is why I understand what the Middle Ages were like better than some. I'll tell you in a moment why, too. When the rays of the Enlightenment began to shine upon these people in the 19th century, and of course, Enlightenment Jews began in the 1840s, heretics began to breed and they began learning languages, but they were expelled in the community and rather in disfavor. But when the sun of the Enlightenment began, the following happened. Some of the frozen mass remained frozen. Nothing happened. They remained superpowers and outside the system. Some evaporated. Other ones that became Russified or German or whatever, and get modularized. Or assimilated more to some degree. That's Eisenstein's parents, for example. They were actually baptized as an extreme case. Some turned into rushing streams. The rushing streams took two directions, socialism and Zionism. What he left out was the bourgeois section, which I'm telling you, of people who were cultivated, they were acculturated. They did, so to speak, go to universities. If there had been University of Riga, my father would have gone to it. His brothers did.
But no question of baptism.
Yes, some Jews were baptized, not spoken to. In my family, nobody was baptized. But the neighbors were.
Do you know why that's so?
Eisenstein's parents were known to my parents. Yes. He was an engineer. He was baptized.
Well, why didn't your father think of it either for...
Disgraceful. Weizmann was not religious, not exactly that. This was regarded with horror as a form of treason.
Cultural treason as much as...
Religious culture, you don't distinguish. Now let me tell you, when you say cultural, let me continue my story and you'll see what I mean. In 1914, the war was declared. In 15, it looked as if the Germans might move in because Tannenberg, the great victories of Ludendorff and Hindenburg,
the
Missourian marshes, not far. My family, the Jews of my family, were not loyal Russian citizens. They wouldn't at least have minded the Germans were coming. There were loyal Russian citizens among the Jews, like Aline's father, for example, Baron Ginsburg. He was in a Jewish baron, and he dressed his children in Paris in little military Russian clothes. You see what I mean? Mm. There were such people. Regarded Zionism with horror rather than freedom or fascism. Boring, you see. But my parents were just ordinary Jewish bourgeois. The Germans were just as good as they did in mind. They'd been to Germany often. And of course, the Kaisers had scattered leaflets saying, Meine liebe Juden. And of course, in 1914, Nikolai Nikolaevich, who was the commander in chief, expelled the Jews from their villages in a very violent Within 48 hours, they had to move back in baggage. And then became refugees in Riga. That I remember. Poor Jews arriving in a hurry. I mean, people I couldn't talk to. They didn't talk Yiddish. They didn't know. You see? And suddenly they were accused of potential disloyalty. They were allowed to remain in the towns. But Cossacks and policemen drove them out very brutally. Towards the end of 14, some more thing about October, November 14. And I remember an old man whom I offered some food. I was then six. Five. And the woman with him said, no, don't. He only eats once a day. I never heard of people who only ate once a day. That lingered in my memory. Poor old thing with a stick. That was a very brutal thing. And that created more anti-Russian feeling among the Riga Jews than anything could have done, for obvious reasons. Anyway, they were not, what they were afraid of was being cut off from their woods. Because you see, if the Germans came, because if they were cut off from their forests, the source of income would disappear. So they moved into the heart of Russia in 15. First they moved into a company union town, a little town called Andreapol, not far from a place called Velikie Luki, in the gubernia of Pskov. Now, that was a little village, but about 1,000 peasants. They were called Velikie Selo. They did the cutting of the timber and all the menial tasks. And they sat on the rafts, and they took the lumber to Riga. In front of them was a little village, little town, townlet, hamlet, where lived the clerks, the shopkeepers, the policemen. It was a company union town. 70% were Jews, 20% were Russian merchants, Russian shopkeepers, policemen, etc. It belonged to my family, as such. Thither I was taken. The first place. There I found Jews who lived their own life. It wasn't a ghetto because here were the forests and here were the streets and it wasn't a town. But I realized then religion and secular life were one. You couldn't have got that in Riga, which was too cultivated and too German and too Western really. I mean, if Bruno Walter was the conductor, it couldn't occur. But this was a little town of small town Jews. And they talk Yiddish, and the children talk Russian. Some of them then enter the Cheka. All kinds of things happened. But I remember. And my governess had an affair with a German who was hiding from the Russians and was skulking and didn't want to be arrested. The enemy alien, and that was discovered she was sacked. He lived in some attic not far from my house. It was uncovered. And then there were these officers, Russian officers, waiting here to the front. They read aloud to my mother in the evenings. They flirted with her, and by the light of sort of kerosene lamps, they read Russian stories aloud to her. It was pure Chekhov life, or Turgenev. Next door was the landowner. It was called Kushlev. His name was Andrei. His father was Andrei. His grandfather Andrei. Hence Andrei Apple. Which was in Andrei City, and he was old and drunken and ruined, living out his last life. He had a terrific park, wild evergreen park, to which the clerk's sisters and aunts and I would go picking mushrooms and berries, and the officers came and played balalaikas. That was the last bit of that kind of old Russia which I actually experienced. In that rather remote place, not very remote. But my point is that these people, the religion and secular life were one, as they were in the Christian Middle Ages. The language was drawn from the Bible or from the prayer book, quite naturally. You couldn't ask them, religious or not. Of course they were. They followed the religious rites automatically, mechanically, instinctively. There couldn't be any revolt against it. At the same time, they made money, they were merchants, they had perfectly ordinary relations, some of them talk Russian. That's how the Middle Ages were. If you ask a medieval life of like, you can't say they were all very religious. It's part and parcel of daily thought and life. Yeah. It only ceased very late, I think.
As I understand that account of living in that company town, though, you live not just in one world, but in two
months.
Worlds.
Who
knew
6 months?
But you live in two worlds at
well,
once.
I was
you,
a
live in, you live
I was
in a Jewish
a
world, but you also
I
live...
I was a Russian-speaking child.
Yeah.
I was sent to a little religious school where they taught the Bible, but I could not speak Yiddish. And so this is an unfortunate rabbi or schoolmaster, because I was a grand and child, you see, of the owners. I was treated with excessive respect, at all disagreeable, made up to. The other children, I was a kind of princeling, it was awful. And the rabbi, who knew a little bit of Russian, tried to translate the Bible for me into some kind of pidgin Russian. This didn't last very long. But I was taught the Hebrew alphabet. I was taught the first book of the Bible. Genesis, I think, is about as far as it went. Then towards the end of 15, we moved to Pittsburgh, where the Petrograd, the chief head office was.
I want to stop you from
At that
going
point, there was a certain amount of Hebrew teaching. The life became totally different.
I wanted to... I wanted to ask you, I think, since we've been talking so much about Jewishness, for you to then draw back from the narrative and...
I was brought up as a Jew from
what beginning. Kind of Jew are you? That's
well,
what
that's
it ends
what
up.
I was brought up as a Jew from the beginning and never ceased to be. My point is I never had trouble about that because there never was a time
when
I wasn't 100% Jewish. I didn't believe in God, I didn't believe in the religion, and so I didn't like Jews too much. But there was no question of being something else. That's my point, in my case.
You're easy in your skin.
That's
therefore.
What I mean. That's what I mean. I had no problem. If I'm asked now, what are you? I would not say I'm an Englishman. Other people would say it about me sometimes. I'm a Russian Jew. That is the first and last absolute correct
yes.
description of it.
Yeah.
I've never been anything else. I'm an Anglophile.
An Anglophile Russian Jew. But
well, I'm devoted to England. I would perish with it. I mean, they've done everything for me, and my loyalty to England is total. But that's all. But I never let them follow me.
Your loyalty is total, but your identity is somewhere else.
Exactly. I'm a metic. I'm a metic. In the end, I'm a metic. I'm a resident foreigner. I mean, I'm completely dedicated. I do what they do. I serve this country. I mean, I wouldn't leave it, and so on. You see, when asked to have jobs in America, I wouldn't dream of accepting them.
Yeah.
I never did. All this has happened constantly, as you can imagine. But, you see, I came here at the age of 10, and that was it.
Okay, I want to go back, though.
But my accent isn't that of an Englishman.
No, no.
Not really, I don't know what it is. But it's something funny.
It's of your own invention, I think.
Perhaps, but if I'm asked by some of you, say something exotic, something odd. It's not foreign. But nor is it English.
Yeah. Just before I get you back, when you say you're a Russian Jew, what part of you is Russian, then?
Quite a lot. I once delivered a speech on this subject, and I got a degree at the, I think, Tel Aviv University, maybe. No, and I got a Jerusalem Prize, which should never have been given me, meant for virtuous foreigners who are friendly to Israel, no point in giving it to him, sort of close to Newcastle, ludicrous. It was given to me by Mr. Begin. That's the story too. Although I wouldn't shake hands on them, okay, I must tell you that, interpolated. In 1961 or two, I was in Jerusalem with my wife and Robert Silvers, who until then thought that the Jews were just a fanatical, militant sect with guns. Shooting at it directly.
1961.
It's 1961. I just took a usual left-wing line. About frightful. Once I persuaded him to come to Israel, we discovered the Jews quarrel among themselves constantly. And every sort of party, total democracy among themselves. And every sort and kind of person. They weren't at all united. Far from it. They weren't beleaguered people all sort of sitting on their walls with guns. That made a difference to him. And they really did. We just saw it happen within a week. It was enough. And then I got into a lift, or elevator, confirmed the court itself. And the King David had told, the dwarf is very attractive. And another man came in. And the man looked at me and said, I think we met someone. What is your name? I said, oh, that, that name has been heard in these parts. My name has been Arthur Begin. Put up his hand. I didn't shake it. I'm a total coward. If I'd thought, perhaps I would have done. It was a chemical reaction. Of an instinctive. I was in Palestine in 47.
And it's a chemical reaction to Jabotinsky.
Terrorism. No, not Jabotinsky.
It's terrorism. The bombing of the King David Hotel itself.
That sort of thing. That sort of thing. I was in Zion 47 when horrors were going on. I hate terrorism and I had an immediate reaction against bloodshed. You see? Which I was totally horrified by. The kind of Zionism I believed in was a weak sort of weak tea. I mean, a sort of liberal Zionism of the most Western possible kind.
Right.
You see? And suddenly this man, well, he didn't notice it, I think. Mm. Of course, we then met afterwards, when I was given this prize. I had to shake hands with him. I did. By this time, he was Prime Minister.
Yeah.
That time, he was not.
Now, in that speech, at the time of getting the Jerusalem Prize...
I said there were three strands in my life. One is Russian, one is Jewish, one is English. And then I tried to trace what the Russian strand came from, came with my sort of, fundamentally, really, my... interest in Russian literature, my fascination with certain Russian values. The things I've been writing about, history ideas is really stimulated by reading Herzen. Across Kumi I came accidentally in the London Library. The Russian-Jewish part was obvious. The Jewish part
But that would make Russianness much more an elective affinity discovered in exile, curiously enough, or strengthened in exile.
No, I think it was. I think it probably was. I mean, I don't know that for when I was 10, I didn't feel any. If you'd asked what I was at the age of 9, I couldn't have understood the question. I was a Jew, I was a Russian. What do you mean? I was a Russian Jew like a lot of people, other people I knew. Like Mr. Leonard Shapiro. And everybody else said
that. Right.
Who I knew in still new material.
Okay. Well, let's not pursue that further, because I will look at the Jerusalem
Jabotinsky
Prize.
Jabotinsky is a very odd story.
Yes, no, that's another issue. I wanted to get back, though.
The English part was political, really. The notion of compromise, the notion of a, if you see what I mean, of a decent human existence, of, as it were, the sort of minimal decency of public life.
Yeah.
And I think in English. I mean, the language I think in. Is up for English. You see? And that's why I'm steeped. And my values are English values, or not Russian values, or Jewish values.
Let's go back to the moment of your birth. Now it's truth, time for. Now
truth and falsehood, good and bad, these are purely English.
Yeah.
Private morality.
Yeah.
It's not. I look on the Jews or on Russians through ultimately, I'm sorry to inform you, English eyes.
Why should you be sorry to inform me?
No, but I mean...
Because I have no expectations that you should judge them otherwise.
But that is so.
Yeah.
In that sense, I'm anglicized. But I know that I'm different. Yes.
You don't feel a fault line between these three identities, a sense that they're not fused, that they lay on top of each other uneasily?
No, I did not feel that. No, they're tangled up. They're tangled in some way. They form a rope.
You form them into a rope by your writing, by your thinking.
They form themselves into a rope. It wasn't a deliberate act. It wasn't a policy. It was fine.
It's a consequence, though, of a certain kind of life.
Yes. It's a meeting certain sort of people.
Okay. We have to up the violins now because we have to tell the story of your birth.
Well, why is it so about?
Well, you haven't told me about being born.
How can I put that? I can't remember it.
What is the story?
It is the story. My parents had a stillborn child, originally. My mother had puerperal fever. which didn't die, but is still never to have children again. She was my father's first cousin. He was passionately in love with her. She married him in order to get out of her father's house. She wanted to be a pupil of Rimsky-Korsakov. In Petersburg, she had a cousin called Raoul something, which was already highly emancipated. It wasn't called Abraham Samuel or anything of that kind. Raoul Ginsburg, his name was. He was a friend of Korsakov, and he arranged for her to go to him, and he said, yes, he would take her on. She had a beautiful voice, but her father stamped on it. The first thing she wanted to do was to get out of her father's house. The only way of doing that was by marrying. My father was rich. But it stands in those days, her father was poor, although they were first cousins. So she married, she was fond of him, she liked him, she was Miller, they came from the same universe, but loving him, I didn't think she ever did much. That's why she wanted a child. And that's why I was born.
Sorry, I don't
That's why I was born. She wanted to have a child. So obviously her love and affection would be centered on something. She was a very passionate, powerful, feminine sort of woman. And she was a terrific Jewess. In no way Russian. She was a Jewish nationalist, a pre-Zionist character. That did have an influence on me inevitably. Now I'll tell you a story about her, and you'll see what she's like. I was born in 1909. I was a semi-Caesarian birth because I didn't emerge from the womb at all comfortably, and I was seized by a not very skillful German surgeon by my left arm, which made it produced a bad arm forever. It could have been operated on, I think. The only person who had an arm like mine was the Kaiser. Unless I can hear that. I can't tie a bow tie, I can't play the violin, I can't play the flute.
Because
I can't,
you can't raise your arm to your...
I can't. It only goes up here, then I can do it to the other end. But the muscles didn't really work. It does anything you like, but it goes as far as this. The bottom does anything you like. It's weaker. My left shoulder is more, slopes more. But the result is I couldn't, I'm of course incapable of, can't join armies and so on. Save me from death at least. Now I've always had a bad arm. I've never felt a cripple. That I've not. But I played cricket, I played football.